This is Through the Years, a history of Cape Breton recordings. Join us on a musical journey through the decades featuring the vocals, songs, and stories of Cape Breton recording artists who have made an impact at home and abroad.
The fiddle music of Cape Breton has its own sound, artistic standards, performance practices, and etiquette. Chief among its characteristics are the partnering of the fiddle with a distinctive piano style, a repertoire that has much locally composed music, and a connection with dance that continues to act as a template for style and performance practice.
There's Gaelic in the fiddle, like the Gaelic in the glen. A song's take on new meaning, boy, she's getting dark again.
Winston Scotty record.
The Cape Breton Fiddler is performing a music that was transplanted from the highlands and islands of Scotland in the 18th and 19th centuries. It was adapted and evolved as it passed down through several generations, each of its exponents carrying an inherited responsibility to maintain the music's integrity while also making it relevant for contemporary audiences. One person who has been heavily involved in the promotion of Celtic music over the years is writer-broadcaster Dan MacDonald. Born in Craignish, MacDonald's background includes several significant families of fiddlers, the MacDonalds of Craignish and the MacCachrans of Queensville on his father's side, and the MacDonalds of Kingsville on his mother's. This leads to a web of musical relations across Cape Breton and beyond, but he himself did not learn to play the fiddle. But he has promoted Celtic music in other ways. He's coordinated, stage managed, and acted as MC for a series of Celtic music concerts. He's acted as a booking agent for artists such as Janelle and Cameron and J.P. Cormier. And his primary business interests are linked to music. As a broadcaster in the 70s and 80s, Dan MacDonald hosted Celtic and East Coast music shows. He's written for a number of publications over the years, and since 2000 has contributed a regular column on fiddle music and entertainment to the Cape Breton Post. Dan MacDonald has acted as a stage manager, site manager, MC, and trainer for Celtic Colors, and he and his wife's promotion of Cape Breton fiddle music has been acknowledged by several organizations. Dan MacDonald is uniquely qualified to talk about Cape Breton fiddle music, and in this edition of Through the Years, we're going to talk with Dan, getting his personal insights into the music he grew up so closely with and has been so involved in. I began by asking Dan, who grew up in Inverness County, which is literally the hotbed of Celtic and fiddle music, how the culture he grew up around influenced his early days and shaped his life to come.
My father was a player in his day, and he was 50 when I was born, so he was kind of out of it at that point in time. I remember him playing when I was young. But he developed arthritis quite bad, worked for the Power Commission, worked outdoors in all kinds of weather, and developed arthritis in his hands, and didn't play until I was probably in my late teens again before he picked it up when he retired. He unfortunately passed away when I was only 19. But I had gotten interested in. I was always interested in music. There was always music at the house. That's just where they come. The relatives would come and the friends would come and play. And it wasn't unusual to have people like Dan R. MacDonald and Dan Huey McCarron and his brother John Willie and the other relatives on the other side of the family in there playing music on a Sunday afternoon. Or we'd be at one of their houses. So I was surrounded by it. But maybe because my father didn't play on a regular basis, I didn't get much of a chance to play. He always said he didn't have a very good fiddler. In later years, I was able to understand what he meant when the fiddle exploded, when we tried to do some work with it. There was always the influence there. My father was also the person that organized the square dances up home. Okay. And so he was the guy that booked the music and would go down to the hall, prep the hall, and so on. So even as a kid of 6, 7, 8 years old, I'd be down there with my father helping getting things ready. We didn't live too far of the hall, would walk home, you know, around the time the dance would start. But it was through that I met people like John Allen Cameron and Buddy McMaster was always a favorite. There was a buddy and his sister, Betty Lou, would be playing. And John Allen would come over from St. of X, where he was at the time, hitchhike over, which he wasn't supposed to do as a student of St. of X, with his guitar in hand and come and play for the dance and earn a few dollars and go home, get a ride down to his family home with Buddy and spend the weekend and go back on Sunday. So for me, it was just natural to do it. When I was in my mid-teens, my 15 years old or so, actually the summer I turned 15, I was involved with the youth club. We had dances. And 2 weeks into the summer dances, the rock and roll dances, the band broke up, and we had to find another band. And my mother, knowing that you'd have to make long-distance calls for something like this, said, okay, you can make the calls. And that was a big deal back in the 60s to make a long-distance phone call. So we did find out there was somebody playing and a band playing in Lewisdale. And we tracked down somebody in Lewisdale that knew the connection, and the band was from Shady Camp, and it was the Phantoms. Okay, so that's my background. It was just kind of a natural thing to do. My father was also involved in the concerts in Craignish, and we used to have outdoor concerts for a number of years. Not that many, but a number of years. And he was involved, and I would have been involved getting ready for the concerts and seeing how it going and running around doing things. I would be in my early teens, maybe at that point in time, 10, 11, 12. And anyway, that was just the way, you did it. But so I was surrounded by it. I didn't play. Danced a bit in my day. Mm-hmm. I was always surrounded by it. So when it came time, particularly when I was involved in radio and in places like New Glasgow, and somebody wanted to do something, I'd end up being the guy helping to organize it.
Okay.
And then when I came to Sydney and ended up working with Gear Radio many, many moons ago, and ended up eventually getting on a radio, going to work with, doing some work with the university, and ended up being the person that was involved with putting on a concert series there. And from there to into the Gorham Society, from there to the Benyon Fiddle and Folk Festival, and then through things like Celtic Colors, the Stan Rogers Festival, and so on. I've always been one of the people behind the scenes and functions like that. And even, for example, the Coast Radio concert that was on. I mean, I was the stage manager for that and helped get that in place and so on. So that's what I've done. It's been the part of the business that I've done, or a part of the part of the business that I've done. I've also been involved with as an agent for people like John Allen Cameron, J.P. Cormier, et cetera, et cetera, when I worked with Rave Entertainment. Didn't think I knew that much about it until I started there and realized, yeah, I do. And, it was just kind of natural because I had already been booking for the Benyon Fiddle and Folk Festival, for example. I was the guy booking the acts for the show, making the contacts, negotiating the contracts, and so on. And then to be on the other side of the fence, representing an artist and trying to get them booked.
Right.
I knew exactly where the person on the other side of the phone was coming from, So that was it. But my interest has always been in music. I'm surrounded by it, grew up with it, and so on. And the fiddle music was the basis, but, there's a lot of good music out there, not just fiddle music.
You're listening to Through the Years, a retrospective on the history of recorded music in Cape Breton. We're speaking with Dan McDonald, noted writer, broadcaster, and entrepreneur, and we're getting his perspective on the development of Cape Breton fiddling and the evolution of the recording of that music.
When you were growing up, would you say you listened to more of the rock and roll or more of the fiddle when you were growing up?
Depends on what day of the week it was, literally. My sister and I were kind of the oddities around school. My sister was a couple of years older than I was. But we could go and enjoy a square dance. And we went to Glendale and Glencoe would have been the two ones that would have run all summer. And you'd go there every Thursday night in Glencoe and every Saturday night in Glendale. And then you could actually literally go six nights a week to a dance somewhere if there was a car going there, And we'd go and have a good time. We could go equally as well, both of us, to a rock dance and have a good time. Our friends who went to the rock dances and the people that we went to school with could never figure out why we'd go to a square dance until it got to the point where they were old enough to drink and they'd go to the dances that would be happening. They used to be something that they classified as pig and whistles, and that came from a name that came from a TV show, which was the Carlton Show Band, when that strong Cape Breton connection there. But the pig and whistles would usually be a band that would play around dancing. And in our area would be the McNamara's Band or Bill McDonald's Band, for example, and the fiddler, like Buddy McMaster or Don Angus Beaton, or, in later years, Ken Beaton and so on. And you'd go there, and we had been dancing since we were square dancing since we were 10 or 12 years old. And our classmates, who were at that point in time, were old enough to drink, so at that point it would have been 20, 21, had never square danced in their life. And then they realized, hey, this is fun. You know, we're able to say, hey, this is what you missed all those years because you thought there was nothing to it, But for the outsiders looking at it, they couldn't figure out why we'd enjoy that. But we went and enjoyed it because it was the type of place where I, as somebody who was 15 could ask a girl to dance, and it didn't mean anything. It was just that she was a good dancer. I wanted to dance with her. If you could be serious, you could have, you could try and arrange a date out of it, but you could also dance with somebody who was 40 years old. And and even you go to now to West Malibu, and you'll see them literally from 8 to 80 in a square set, and there's nothing shocking about it. It's just that those people want to dance. And, you know, you want to come out and dance with me? Come with me, and we'll take you out to take you to a square set, you know? And that's very socially acceptable for that. And that was the way that the social gathering
was. If you could do it well.
But the thing is, you only did well by doing it and being able to literally go where you're pushed.
Right.
You know, and by the time you had done it two or three times or four times, you had an idea. Okay, now I turn, I go this way. And I promenade with the girl, you know, and so on. And when you went to different dances, you go to a place like Marguerite Forks, for example, or Southwest Marguerite, they danced a different style of dancing than they did in Malibu or Judik.
Malibu, because they're not that far away.
Malibu and Glendale danced different styles. Okay, back then the Glendale did an abbreviated version of the first figure, which is what has become more prominent. They did a much more stylized version in Malibu, for example. In Southwest Marguerite, they did a different style. You went to Shetty Camp, they did a different style. You went to Washabuck, in Bedeck, they did a different style. Iona area, and East Bay, Big Pond, did a different style. And you go down north of Smoky, and you can go all day and never do the same set. You know, whatever was there. And there are people in different areas who have revived it. There's people actually that now will teach a down north set, and some of them are fascinating to watch. And you say, how did they ever come up with that? But they're based on who the settlers were, where the people went to dance. My father remembered there being a four figure square set, and when he was playing in the 30s, there'd be a four figure square set. And that blended into a three-figure set that we have now. In Antigonish County, there was five figures, which blended into four, which blended into three. And they took the second and third figure, put them together, just didn't stop dancing, just kept going. Same style of music, jig or reel. And then the fourth and fifth went together in one.
Okay.
But that's the real semantics of the dancing.
This is Ron Neville, and you're listening to Through the Years, the History of Recorded Music in Cape Breton. I'm speaking with Dan MacDonald, noted writer and broadcaster who grew up in the atmosphere of fiddling in Cape Breton. After having explained the variations on the different types of dancing, I asked him if the same variations occurred with the fiddling.
Yes and no. The style would be very similar in, let's say, Inverness County. You get into Richmond County, a little bit different playing. Victoria County, a little bit different, because in a lot of cases in Victoria County, let's say the Iona area, there wouldn't be as much step dancing, whereas in Malibu, for example, or Judik, you would have a lot of step dancers. And it was just the way that they would do it. Where you'd get to, you know, East Bay would be a little bit different. You'd have a mixture of it, but you'd go to New Waterford and you'd have step dancers because you had people from Inverness County living in New Waterford, and they, you know, the second and third generation of them who would be going back and forth, and they would have learned to dance there. Glace Bay, different story. You know, they wouldn't be as much in the square dancing style of thing in Glace Bay because there wasn't as many Inverness County settlers in Glace Bay.
Oh, I thought maybe they might have come here for the coal mines or whatever.
Yeah, well, they did. The ones in New Waterford came for the coal mines.
Okay.
Came down to work in the coal mines.
Not so much in Glace Bay, then.
They came to New Waterford.
Okay.
They didn't come to Glace Bay. Okay. They came to Sydney for the steel plant, and they came from to New Waterford. But not, you know, you can trace most families in New Waterford to somebody in Inverness County. And it's the same, you go to Newfoundland, the Caudroy Valley in Newfoundland was settled by Cape Bretoners. It was opened, that area was originally part of the French territory. And by French, I mean France. And when the French finally relinquished it to the British, it wasn't open to settlers. When they did open it to settlers, it was people literally from Port Hood to Shetty Camp that settled it. So you've got names like LeBlanc, Chaisson, and MacDonald and MacIsaac, and, you know, and a lot of musicians in there. So you have a Gaelic-speaking and French-speaking tradition in the Caudroy Valley in Newfoundland, which is the same as Inverness County, parts of Inverness County, and the same connections to New Waterford. Because a lot of the people that came to New Waterford to the mines, their brother went to Codroy to farm, okay, because there was land there.
Okay.
You know, and you have a lot of connections. And one of the big names is MacArthur. There's MacArthur's in Mabu and Judic, who were related to MacArthur's in, and a MacDonald family as well, who were related to the MacArthur music, the heavy music family in Newfoundland, in the Codroy. And again, MacDonald's there. And they came, some of them lived, came from over there and came to New Waterford because they had relatives there, and one of them just passed away not that in the last couple of years, the last of the MacArthur music plant. There are still MacArthur players. Lisa, right. MacArthur, if you ever hear her, a great fiddler from the Codroy Valley originally, who lives in Halifax now, but plays, she's been in, if you ever run across her CD, this is one of the nicest CDs that you'll ever listen to as far as the Cape Breton style playing, but she's from Newfoundland.
So she's got that influence.
She got that influence, and that was the influence that was there. It was a Gaelic. There's a book by Margaret Bennett called "The Last Stronghold," and it's about the Gaelic speakers in the Codroy Valley. And there was a large Gaelic settlement there in the whole Codroy Valley. Codroy Valley is a big area. It's like the Margaries. If you look, you start at one end of the Margaries and go right through to the other end, it's a big territory. The same in the Codroy Valley there. And it was two rivers when they went down, and it was originally one river. When they went down, there was two rivers running down, and the center part, you had 3 or 4 feet of good quality farming soil. So it was the
farming area.
Big basically. Farming area, yeah. But again, Kibretners that settled it. Right. For the most part, you know?
Yeah.
This is Ron Neville, and you're listening to Through the Years, the history of recorded music in Cape Breton. In this episode, we're speaking with Dan MacDonald, noted writer, broadcaster, and entrepreneur, who grew up in Inverness County, the area where fiddling really came to prominence. Our conversation next turned to the early recordings of fiddle music in Cape Breton and Celtic music in general. I asked Dan about the importance of those early recordings.
They would have been quite important. In a lot of circles, there wouldn't have been that many in, for example, rural Inverness County that would have had anything to play it on. But if you did go to a house, it'd be like when TV came out. You know, you'd go to somebody's house because they had the TV. Mm-hmm. You know, you're going to watch the hockey game, you know. Or so-and-so's got a couple of new 78s that just came in from their cousin in Boston, you know. Mm-hmm. And that would be, you'd go and he could make a night because there'd be you'd have some recordings there, particularly in the 30s, when you got into the 30s, and there was more recordings there. It was a wind-up gramophone. There was one in our house, steel needles. And I remember my father, in the late 50s, buying 78s at the Celtic Music Store in Antigonish. Somebody who had just released, and it was probably the last of the 78s that had been released. But they would listen to them, learn tunes from them, whenever, you know, something was there. And you'd play it over and over again until you learned the tune. There wouldn't be a huge number that could read music proficiently. There would be some. Mm-hmm. They would absorb it. They would listen to it. I remember my father talking about he and his father and his uncle sitting around listening to the New Carlisle in the Gaspé radio station, which at the time was part English, part French. But they had a show on several times a week, as did Charlottetown, CFCY in Charlottetown. This is in the 1930s now, that would feature fiddle music. And they'd sit around with the fiddles, listening to try and catch a new tune, because they had to play a dance on Saturday night and they wanted to have a new tune, okay? And they'd be listening to people like Jerry and the Hayshakers, or whose lead fiddler was at the time was, I believe, Jean Carignan.
Okay.
Jean Carignan would have been there, and Carignan was a phenomenal fiddler in his day. He was a cab driver in Montreal, but I've seen a National Film Board piece on him, and they did a slow motion of his bow and the bow hand.
Okay.
And you can't see it. It's that fast.
Wow.
His bowing was just exceptional. He had a drive to his playing. Different, little bit different style, but he had high respect for the Celtic music, the Celtic. And in Montreal, there would have been a fair bit of Irish influence. In Montreal and Quebec City, the eastern townships, there would have been a lot of Irish settlers in that area, he would have gathered up some tunes from there. I would love to have heard him live, but when in his later years, his hearing started to deteriorate. But I did see him on TV.
Okay.
It was, you know, you'd say, whoa, where did this guy come from? He would have been the bowing on him like Ashley McIsaac nowadays. You'd look at it and say, whoa, you know, how did he do? How's he doing that? It's worthwhile checking out the National Film Board piece that on Carignan. He's just a phenomenal player. But his music, he would have come into the studio, because you couldn't play the same tunes every time that you were in the studio. He would have come into the studio to do a broadcast with new tunes.
Mm-hmm.
And the tunes, they'd be sitting in Craignish, listening on the crackly radio and trying to catch the tune, you know? My father was, and his uncle in particular, Angus, were good whistlers. And when they'd hear a new tune, they'd be at a dance somewhere, they'd hear a new tune. And, of course, the traditional way is to play the tune through twice. This is an A part and B part, and then you play the A and the B again. So by the time they hit the A part again, my father would have picked it up and was whistling. And he might go outside and whistle it over and over again until it was in his brain.
Fine,
you know.
Yeah.
And a lot of tunes would have been passed along like that. As soon as he came home, he'd be picking up the fiddle to try and get it, you know. And the music was passed along like that, you know.
You're listening to Through the Years, a retrospective on the history of recorded music in Cape Breton. We're speaking with Dan MacDonald, noted writer, broadcaster, and entrepreneur, and we're getting his perspective on the development of Cape Breton fiddling and the evolution of the recording of that music.
Now, you were talking about the Celtic Music Store in Antigonish, and I know that is, that store and the record company that came out of that store eventually was very influential in as far as Cape Breton music. But let's go back maybe a little bit and talk about the early recordings of Cape Breton music, and to your knowledge, where you first started listening to, you know, the early recordings you started listening to that were, you know,
it would have been stuff from Celtic music in Antigonish, because my father would have had a collection of it. But it goes back before that. They were the first Cape Bretoners who left here specifically to record. Would have done it in 1935. I think the 78s were released in 1936, but it was recorded, I believe, in the fall of 35. And that would have been Angus Allen Gillis, Dan J. Campbell, and Angus Chisholm. So Angus Allen and Dan Jay would have been well acquainted with each other. They would have been about the same age, same era. Angus Chisholm would have been young at that time. There was another fiddler, Sandy McLean, who was supposed to go with them as the third fiddler, and something happened and he didn't make the trip. But Angus Chisholm was in, would have been probably in 20-ish at the time, but was he was in, I believe, Antigonish when they stopped in Antigonish. The piano player that went with them was from Antigonish. And they went to Compo Records in Montreal and recorded there, and Bernie paid the shot for having the recordings. I don't know if the musicians, they would have gotten all their expenses paid, I suppose.
That's Bernie McIsaac.
Bernie McIsaac, yeah. And he was influential in getting the first ones recorded. Now, before that, They would have been recordings on Brunswick Records from Huey McDonald and Colin J. Boyd. And Colin J. Boyd had a little bit different swing to him, more Reagan-ish, Pictou County type swing. But Huey was very much closer to the Cape Breton style of playing. So they would have recorded on, I believe it was Brunswick Records, way back in the early 30s. But they would have done it away. They didn't specifically go away. They happened to be away and record it. And then previous to that, was in 1927, was the Caledonia Scotch Band, which included Charlie McKinnon and big Dan Huey McCachern, who was not to be confused with Dan Huey, the composer, but they were related.
Okay.
I believe first cousins. But anyway, they were the original ones. They were members of Dan Sullivan's band in the Boston area. Dan Sullivan was an Irish piano player, and who played on the original recordings that they did. And then there was also accompanied by a banjo player from Prince Edward Island. But that was that was the first. One, the first time you get anything that represented the Cape Breton, quote-unquote, Cape Breton style music. Then Huey and Colin J. Boyd, then Angus Allen Gillis and Dan J. Campbell and Angus Chisholm making the trip to Montreal to record. And I think there was like seven recordings came out of that. In the meantime, there was performers in Boston that would have started to record shortly after that, 37, 38, I believe it was Alec Gillis and the Inverness Serenaders, which included people like Al Cid O'Coyne and so on. Now, ironically, my father had a sister in Boston, and my father would go up there in the wintertime and work with there. She had a boarding house that she had in a restaurant, and her and her husband, and my father would be up working around there, and of course, hitting the music scene up there, and got to know a lot of the players, and they'd have a lot of Cape Breton fiddlers to be there because not everybody would be available for every gig. So people would be working and so on. And my father played a number of times with them because he'd be the second. And they'd usually have two or three fiddlers that they'd have. And my father sat in with them and played a number of times at different gigs, but was never officially listed. And because it was just who's available,
right?
So if and sometimes they'd be playing at two different venues at the same time with Alec in one, and Al Cid O'Coyne, who was his brother-in-law, heading the other group.
Oh, okay.
Both of those recorded solo, and the Inverness Serenaders recorded as a group as well. So, and usually what they do is if they did a solo side, one side would be Alec Gillis and the other side would be Al Cid. So they'd split it aside a piece, and nobody was getting rich off it. That's for sure at that point in time. But that continued on. That type of thing continued on into the 40s. Of course, they were broken up by the war, the late 40s, and into the 50s. And in that time, Bernie McIsaac and the Celtic Music label began to expand out, and they also did recordings of vocalists. Some Gaelic, a few Gaelic singers and things like that as well. But that's taking it into the 60s. At that point in time, the Celtic Music label was in the process of being sold. Okay, it was sold to
Rodeo?
Rodeo Records, yeah, and which was eventually sold ARC, which, you know, Rodeo and ARC, Banff Records was another one, and all this music that had been recorded.
Caprice and Canadian Cavalcade and all a bunch of those.
All those, yeah, they're all owned by a guy by the name of George Moss, who was in Montreal. And I tried to track him down. Actually, I did track him down and found him and trying to track down some information on something quite a number of years ago, and he's now deceased. But George Taylor, again, was involved in that as well. But George Moss was the guy that that owned it, owned the music. But you can see any number of LPs or CDs on the go now with stuff from Joe McDougall and Bernie Lee playing or Joe McIsaac playing, or Angus Chisholm playing, or whatever, and they never got a cent for it, you know. And it was just that somebody else owned the rights and sold the rights to somebody else, who sold the rights to somebody else, that repackaged it another way and put them together with some upper Canadian players like Graeme Townsend, for example, and his wife Elder, and so on. The stuff is still available. It's still out there. You can go into any Irving station and leaf through the compact discs, and you'll find something with these old Cabretners on it that was recorded in the 30s or the 40s or in the 50s, you know.
And a lot of the Celtic stuff was bought by Rodeo, and they
repackaged it and recycled it and split it up in other ways and so on, you know. Again, without the musicians having a say in it or getting any money out of it. One of the first ones to react to that was Winston Fitzgerald, who started his own label.
Mac
Records, yeah. And he had, he basically said, well, I'm going to see about getting my own stuff recorded. He recorded on Mac, which was his record, and Johnny Wilmot. They're, the, to my knowledge, the only two that recorded on that. They had LPs. I don't think they had 78s, but I think they had LPs. So we're talking the late 50s, the early 60s.
And there was a connection between Mac Records and CJCB Radio, too, wasn't there?
Yeah, I think they were recorded there. The stuff was recorded there.
Yeah.
You're listening to Through the Years, a retrospective on the history of recorded music in Cape Breton. We're speaking with Dan McDonald, noted writer, broadcaster, and entrepreneur. And we're getting his perspective on the development of Cape Breton fiddling and the evolution of the recording of that music.
Back in the day, the late 1930s, you could go into a studio and rent and record something, okay? And in my possession, I have some 78s that were recorded by Dan R. McDonald and given to my mother and my father and my grandfather. There's four. There was five. I think the other one must have been broken at some point in time and tossed. But I did get them redone, cleaned up and put on, and five of the eight sides that were there, you could still hear them.
Okay.
He recorded his first one at CJCB because the studio was there and it could be recorded. It'd be similar to this here because they would record their own shows. They'd record their own commercials. The production facility was there to do it on a 78. You'd have a single copy 78. It was like making a cassette, okay, recording something on your cell phone now. That would be, you'd get a glimpse of something. But they would sit down and they'd, okay, start, you got 3 minutes. And they would know in advance that they had 3 minutes and they would have timed it out to go to 3 minutes. And there was some of those that were around, the single copies that were around. I know Dan R. also recorded in Hamilton, Ontario, when he was working up there. And, you know, you'd get one. That's where the one from my mother and father came from. When he set that down, that was something that he gave to them as a wedding gift.
Oh, really? Okay.
And that was the, because the Denar was a regular at our house. Weren't related. There was a distant family connection there, but not wasn't related. And Denar had spent quite a bit of time at my with my grandfather and as a younger man and with my father and counted them as friends. So when mom and dad got married, that was when he came back from the war, he came came to Craignish, stayed with my father and mother for at the time. My grandfather was still alive, and then he went to Hamilton. When he was in Hamilton, he recorded these and sent them down. He had tunes that he had composed for them,
and he composed quite a number I heard something like the number around 2,000.
Yeah, that's the best guess that they've got. They keep on unearthing things that they think are Denar, but Denar would write on anything in the back of a calendar, for example. You know, he'd have a thought, and there'd be nothing that would be that'd be safe when Denar was around. He'd write on anything. You know, if the thought get he had a tune would get in his head, and so on. And he had piles of these scraps of paper around that had tunes on them. And you know, he was such a prolific composer. But he also, when he was overseas, for example, he was sending tunes home to his friends. He'd write them, and he'd play them, and he'd learn them, and he'd write copies and send them home to people like Ellie Frances McKay, who was a good friend, or Buddy McMaster, who was a young up and coming player at the time, would have been in his, by the time the war ended, would have been around 20 or so, maybe a little bit older than that. But Denar was just a incredible composer, as was Dan Huey McCahern, although Dan Huey wasn't quite as prolific as Denar was. Mm. But Dan Huey, again, somebody who didn't record professionally. Denar did.
Was it on? It was on Celtic.
Yep.
Okay.
But he also recorded with the Five McDonald Fiddlers.
Right.
Okay. And when he was in Detroit, and it was financed by Celtic, the Celtic Music label, to the Studio Time, and that they did it in Detroit or Windsor, I'm not sure, but they were all Inverness County players except for one, who was an Ontario player. But they were all great players in their own right, put it together. Now, to have a group of players playing, that was pretty significant, you know, to get that, you know, and the nuances that they were able to put into the music. It wasn't unusual in, for example, Alec Gillis and the Inverness Serenaders, and three, you know, having three players, two fiddlers, or three fiddlers was common. And going back a little further, it wasn't unusual for fiddlers to team up to play at dances because there was no sound system.
Okay.
And they would, one would play the regular, somebody else would play on the bass strings.
Okay.
And would carry better, you know.
I think Winston was the first one to use amplified.
Winston probably would have been, but then again, he was in Sydney. It was available. If you were in Judic, it wasn't as available.
Right.
You know? But getting to the point where if you were going to be the only fiddler, you had to have amplification. That was something that would have come in the late 50s, early 60s, for example.
Well, when did electricity come to Cape Breton, like full on?
It would have been come through our area in 1944.
44, okay.
There was electricity in certain areas. My father was one of the ones that he worked for, eventually worked for the Oasis Power Commission, but he was one of the people that operated the generating station in Port Hawkesbury, and he had a number of years experience with MT&T initially, stringing lines, and with Nova Scotia Power stringing lines, and ended up getting a job in Port Hawkesbury and pre-war, and was still there. But one of the reasons why he tried to sign up, he was too old for one thing to go to war. He was born in 1904. He would have been 35 when the war broke out, but he was also an only son. He also worked for an essential service, which was the generating station, and that was one of the things that kept him in one piece, probably. But anyway, he eventually worked into being with the Nova Scotia Power Commission and retired from that in 1969. But the amplification, it went down Route 19 in the late 40s, okay, which had been in through Inverness County. But even in my day, growing up, there were houses in the community that didn't have electricity. So it was, you know, it would be, and we'd, my father, even if they were installing electricity, I remember my father being the guy that would go to do the installation or wire the house, you know, for them.
Okay.
Because he knew how to do it, you know. So it's it would have been the halls would have had it, the churches would have had it, the church halls themselves would have had it, and so on. But that, even with that, when you'd have amplification, getting amplification would be, even with the lights on, it wouldn't necessarily be a power, you know, a
power source there.
Wouldn't be a Marshall bass amp sitting there, you know, 20 foot high.
You're listening to Through the Years, a retrospective on the history of recorded music in Cape Breton. We're speaking with Dan MacDonald, noted writer, broadcaster, and entrepreneur, and we're getting his perspective on the development of Cape Breton fiddling and the evolution of the recording of that music.
So the fact that some of these players now, they were recording back in the day, and they really weren't getting any kind of compensation for their efforts, mm-hmm. and stuff. Did that discourage a lot of them from stopping playing?
They played because they wanted to play, but there was nobody that was making a living at it.
Mm.
Okay, even somebody like Winston Fitzgerald, who was so famous, had a radio show. Dan Joe McGinnis had his own radio show, and Winston, but they had day jobs. Everybody had a day job. It's only in the last 20 years, really, where, you know, there were people that would be able to make a living as a musician. You know, that was unheard of. Even someone like Jerry Holland who was a furniture maker, a carpenter and a furniture maker. That's what he did, you know. You know, he played all over the world.
Right.
Buddy McMaster. Buddy worked for CN.
And he didn't record until
later. He was 65.
Yeah.
He recorded, you know, and yeah. Buddy used to, I remember teasing Buddy and saying that, when are you going to record, Buddy? One of these days. I said, Buddy, you know, you kick the bucket, I said, and somebody's going to put a wonderful recording together of stuff that they got from you. You won't have any say in it.
Mm.
And, you know, you might be right, you know. Buddy was so quiet and humble and such a pleasure to work with and deal with, a great guy. But he was in his 60s before he recorded. After Winston did Mac Records, there was a lull because musicians were realizing that they were being taken advantage of and they weren't getting any compensation for it. And they'd see a singer, for example, who would sell a lot of records, and they were making some money of it. They were able to, and there would have been some Cape Breton singers at that time that were able to do that. Perhaps not here, but they would have moved away to do it. And they realized that they were being shortchanged. So it wasn't until the 70s when there was Rounder Records in Boston. Did an approach, and they started with the fiddlers that were in Boston. Joe Cormier, for example. A great player, Machete Kemp, JP's uncle, one of the most wonderful dance players that you'd ever hear. And there's two albums of LPs of Joe's. One is called The Dances Down Home, and the other is just called Joe Cormier. It's a white album with Joe's picture on it. Two of the best albums of dance music that you'd ever want to hear. Still easily in my top 10 John Campbell was there. And John was in Boston at the time and playing and recorded. And when they came back to Gibraltar, of course, they came back on a regular basis, and they were able to say, you know, we're getting some money out of this. You know, we're not getting a lot, but we're getting some money out of this, which opened the door to other people to record. When Mark Wilson came down from Boston, Round of Records, at the invitation of some of the ones here, and he came around kind of scouting around and went to some of the concerts and so on and heard some of the players, and then to convince them to go to Boston. It took a little record, a little convincing to do, you know. But you had people like the McClellans, for example, the McClellan Trio, that Donald
and Teresa and Marie.
That recorded an album, and then Teresa and Marie in particular, and they didn't want to release it at that point in time. But that was, as far as Rounder's philosophy was, that was fine. Joe McLean had recorded one and didn't want to release it, and didn't for years. But you had people like Jerry Holland that looked at it and said, "Yeah, you know, let's do this," and recorded did a number of recordings with Rounder and so on. Joe Cormier is probably the most prolific one with Rounder, but Winnie Chafe, our first recordings would have been with Rounder, but they never could convince Buddy. But this all of those people and more that Rounder had its own section for the Cape Breton style music, and even now they've revived it and brought it, and some of those are still available. A lot of those recordings are still available, which is, it's great because they're historic. You know, you're not going to hear a Joe McLean, for example.
No,
you're not going to hear him anymore. Those Joe Cormier, even though Joe lived a good long life, and I heard him play in Shady Camp a couple of years before he died.
It was just in the last year or so that he passed
away,
just
in May of the last year and a half, I think it was. Yeah. And his fiddle is still being played. You know, JP has the fiddle. So
okay,
but his sons were all guitar players. So, the connection was strong for him with Cape Breton, and when Joe died, they gave JP the fiddle, and he played it at Joe's funeral. You know?
Wow!
So it was people like that and a lot of people don't realize that Joe Cormier was given an American National Award for his contribution to culture.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah.
And because he was such a prominent feature in the Boston music scene, as was John Campbell. Now, John was somebody who organized dances up there for years and had people, you know, even in the 50s, people coming up from here. Buddy, for example, on a regular basis. Don Langus Beaton, for example, on a regular basis. They'd each make once or twice a year, make a trip to Boston. John was somebody who suddenly realized, I can do this myself. And did, and went to, you know, put something out himself, was able to sell it, you know, cassettes and CDs, sell it at every gig he had, was able to go to Inverness County and leave some in stores and go back the next year and collect, you know, and so on. That was the start of them in the 70s, realizing, yeah, I can, late 60s, early 70s, we can do this ourselves. That was the start of the independence of the local players, where nowadays, you know, actually nobody's on a label except, well, not even Natalie's on a label, you know.
Okay, I did not know that.
Yep, and they do their own, and they produce their own, record their own, and Ashley, all those people, Wendy McIsaac, for example, and some of the great players that are on the go,
That was the thing that came later. It was all in the early days. I guess it was all fiddle, and then was the fiddle combining with some vocal.
Yeah, exactly. And you would have some vocals. Even Celtic Music label in the 1950s recorded vocals. Alonzo Marsh recording. He was a great singer, and I never heard him live, but I did hear the recordings. But they were still on the Celtic Music label.
You're listening to Through the Years, a retrospective on the history of recorded music in Cape Breton.
We're speaking with Dan MacDonald, noted writer, broadcaster, and entrepreneur. And we're getting his perspective on the development of Cape Breton fiddling and the evolution of the recording of that music.
Probably I ask you, what would you say the most influential, would it be too many to mention, the most influential Cape Breton recordings over the years?
Oh, gosh.
Would that be too wide a swath there?
I think you'd have to go back to Winston Fitzgerald's stuff. Because Winston was one of the players, one of the first ones to play it all over the island. Winston was the first one who would have gotten anything more than a local audience because of his time on radio and his recordings. And then playing he was very much in demand as a dance player. His recordings would have been the first. Joe Cormier would have been influential in a certain other area. Dahl Angus Beaton, Buddy McMaster, even though they didn't record until later, there was all kinds of tape of them around. The more modern day ones, Howie would be an influence to a lot of the younger players. Jerry Holland would be an influence because Jerry had this just beautiful touch. And Howie, I don't know if he patterned himself after Jerry, but Jerry was a big influence, for him. And Jerry's recordings were available. And Howie has been a prolific recorder over the years as well. Then you get into another generation, really, Natalie, Ashley, and so on. The Rankin family, John Morris, Rankin. John Morris's playing was excellent, just wonderful. I mean, that was such a loss when we lost him. Mm-hmm. But it was just, there's a lot now that are out there that are, you look at it, and now there's a new Buddy McMaster recording out.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yep. Done by Joey Beaton, and it was done at Kim Lance's studio in Kelty Drive in Coxeth, Coda studio, and it's recorded live off the floor over the years. That's just out, within the last couple of months that came out. So, but that's that's an historic one. That's the one that, because of what's on it, that's the one that people will gravitate towards. They want that one. And as a matter of fact, Ashley on Facebook is saying, wow, this is it.
So there you have it. The Cape Breton fiddle is a subject unto itself, and whole volumes and even university theses have been written on the subject. Hopefully, with Dan's help, we've given you a better understanding of the origin of some of the great recordings of Cape Breton fiddle. And perhaps maybe it'll even make you want to go out and seek out some of the recordings we talked about on the program here today. Many thanks going out to Dan MacDonald, noted broadcaster and writer and entrepreneur, for his insights into the whole Cape Breton fiddling genre. And thank you very much for listening to this edition of Through the Years. And listen for more more great programs in this series. For Through the Years, the history of Cape Breton recorded music, I'm Ron Neville.
Listening to Through the Years, a history of Cape Breton recordings, a Coast 89.7 original production. The Coast 89.7 would like to thank the Community Radio Fund of Canada for its financial support for this special project.